Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our session about front-end development for back-end developers. I'm going to introduce ourselves first a little bit, if this thing works. There's always something. It's quick, though. There we go. So I'm Frank Volsje, a full-stack .NET developer at Luminous Arnhem. That means I work at the back-end as well as the front-end. And you can always email me after this presentation. Our slides will be up on GitHub. There will be a link at the end. And I will give the presenter to Steve, which will start off with the introduction.
Thank you. My name is Steve Burghout, if this thing works. It's slightly wrong. All right. I can say I'm a Java developer here at the Microsoft conference. I do as well back-end as front-end. I was first mainly focusing on back-end development, Java development, but then Frank introduced me in the way of creating apps in the front-end, and I got enthusiastic, and I just got into it, and that's why we created this presentation, just to show back-end developers what's possible in front-end and how to set up a good project on the front-end. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at some things on how to create an application. It's like a roadmap, so you pick a language, you pick a framework, you need all kinds of libraries, you need it on the back end, but also on the front end you will need that, and a build tool, especially if you have big applications with a lot of libraries here and there, and build processes, maybe automated deployment, so you need a build tool for that. And since front-end front-end applications are growing and growing, you need to ensure some code quality, some standards over the team, so everybody conforms to that. So first we're going to start with the language. I'm a Java developer, and if I start with JavaScript, it just makes me want to flip the table and say, fuck this shit. But I never be sure what this refers to. Is it the global scope? Is it the function scope? Is it block scope? I know. Is there a block scope? I don't think so. So it's just, it makes me so confused every time I go to JavaScript. So, but I don't make web applications. So do I have a choice? Not really. I don't really like JavaScript for a couple of reasons. First off is scoping. So in Java and just as C#, I'm used to have block scopes, but in JavaScript you don't really have block scope. So in Java I would say this would alert 1 instead of 4 because it's in the if and it's not outside that scope. So, but in JavaScript it's not like that. It will alert 4 instead. Modularity. So I'm used to create classes, I make inheritance, and I want to present this readable and without a lot of code I don't need. But in JavaScript, I want to, for example, in here, I create an animal class, and then I inherit with, I get a snake and a horse, and just so much boilerplate code. It's just, it's bothering me. This is the way how to do it in JavaScript, and even this is really nice, and this is for JavaScript standards really nice and neat code. So just imagine. No modularity, well, it's going to change, of course, but in ES5, ECMAScript 5, you don't really have modularity. Just put things on the global scope, and you don't even know it. It's just, it's confusing. And, well, the last point here, false, null, undefined. I think if you work with JavaScript, you probably have encountered this and be confused, like, why is it undefined? Why is it not just a string or whatever? But as I said, we need JavaScript for web development because it's the only scripting language supported by all major browsers. So, and also all the huge libraries and frameworks, they are built in JavaScript. So we just have to cope with it. But fortunately, there are alternatives, or moreover, languages that compile to JavaScript. In total, 147. So I'm not the only one who doesn't like JavaScript or the syntax of JavaScript, because in my opinion, especially ECMAScript 5, there's so much wrong with it. So the three major ones I really like is CoffeeScript. It's a Ruby-like syntax. Babel. Babel is JavaScript with the features of the new JavaScript. So it just translates, so you can write the new ECMAScript features, like classes and other kind of stuff. But it compiles to ECMAScript 5, so you can run it in all the browsers. But the one I like the most is TypeScript, created by Microsoft. I'm going to go deeper into TypeScript. So TypeScript is a superset of JavaScript. So that means valid JavaScript is valid TypeScript. It's optionally typed. So as you probably know, JavaScript is dynamically typed, so you can just put anything into a variable. But TypeScript, you can set static typing, so you can define if it's a string or a number or whatever. But you can also, it also uses type inference. So if you just create a variable and you assign to it, it just knows what it is. So there's syntax highlighting in your Visual Studio or whatever IDE you're using. It's object-oriented, something we are familiar with in the backend world, and which just feels really intuitive in TypeScript. There's a nice module system around it, so you don't just have to put everything on the global scope. You can just neatly put things into namespaces, and you can have things like private or public. And yeah, so because it's statically typed, there's so much better support of the IDEs as well, because it can give us suggestions and with Visual Studio IntelliSense. So as I already told you, TypeScript is a superset of JavaScript, but with the compiler built-in. So you write your TypeScript and it compiles to JavaScript, but and so it can give warnings. If you, for example, have a nice JavaScript file, you can try it. You don't know if it works or not, or if there are errors in it, because JavaScript you only know at runtime. You can just change the name to a TypeScript, put it in the TypeScript compiler, and it'll give you the warnings it will otherwise give you on runtime. So also, you already have your warnings on compile time instead of finding it out on the on runtime, and maybe too late already. So an example that is optionally typed, so a bit of JavaScript. So this is obviously wrong. You have a variable count, you put 1, 2, 3, and there's no way you can do two uppercase on 1, 2, 3, because it's not a spring. But in JavaScript, it will give you the error on runtime, because there's no compile time. In TypeScript, you can, for example, do this. But then it will obviously give a compile error, because you're creating a variable called count and assign 1, 2, 3 to it. But that's not, 1, 2, 3 is not a string. So it will give you a compile error. Number is not assignable to a string. It also have type inference. So if you don't specify the type, like in here, and you do two uppercase, it just knows on compile time that its var count is a number, and in compile time it will have an error, probably property to uppercase does not exist on type number. So this is how the optionally typed system works. A thing about the module system. So there are namespaces, and within the namespaces you define the different classes. And you can define if the classes are visible outside your namespace or just within your namespace. So you can say export. So if you say export, it's visible without outside your namespace, and otherwise it will be just visible within your namespace. So you have something like information hiding and things we're familiar with in the backend world. A little demo of TypeScript. Microsoft has a TypeScript playground. And then there you can play around with TypeScript. On the left-hand side, you see the JavaScript. The TypeScript. On the right side, you see the JavaScript. So this just compiles. We can run it. And if I click say hello, it says hello, but it doesn't say world or anything. But it runs. So let's refactor this code. So left-hand side will be TypeScript, and the right side will be with the compiled JavaScript based on the TypeScript code. So you see a greeter here. We want to make a class of this greeter with the function greet. So we can just refactor this. You already see that there's a compiler inside this this browser. This is because the compiler of TypeScript is also written in JavaScript. TypeScript, I mean, yeah. So we have a class greeter here. And we can make a constructor like, and we can put in a message with the type string. And we can just say this bench greeting. We need to create a member here, so we might want to make it private with type string. All right, then we want to have a method which is greet, and it returns a string. And let's return hello. There's this, it's greeting. And you already see there are suggestions of the compiler because we have a greeting member here. So let's remove this. You see a compile error here, but we want to run this. So just let's run this, and we see the same result. So even though the TypeScript doesn't compile, it will still translate to JavaScript and it will still run on runtime. But let's fix this because we expect a string and not an object. So we can change it here. And let's run it again. And it says, hello world. So this is a short, really simple example of how you can refactor JavaScript to TypeScript, and how easy it is and how intuitive it feels for backend developers, because you just create classes, you create methods, you set return types, etc. So we have set the language, but then we want to go to and pick a framework. So this is what we used to do. So we have a client, and there's sort of a backend, and it just you do a request and it returns HTML. And you do a new request and it again returns HTML. This is really inefficient, and also the user experience isn't really nice this way because it refreshes the page every time. So the first solution was then what they did. Ajax call to do a partial update of the page. So you do again a request and it gives a piece of HTML back and you replace it. But still, that didn't really feel very intuitive. So the answer to that is the SPA framework. So what we want is a website that is fully responsive. So the definition of the SPA framework is then it's a web application which has the majority of the interaction handled in the client without the need have to reach a server with the goal of finding a more fluid user experience. So the idea of a SPA framework is that when you load a page, all the resources for your web application are downloaded from the server and installed on your browser. So you have a whole application already on your browser. So when you go to a new page, it doesn't need to reach for HTML because it has everything already. It just reaches data because it needs extra data. And it puts it into the page. So the whole page is the whole application, web application is already on your browser. So that will create a more fluid user experience this way. So SPA framework, but which one will you choose? You're not familiar with SPA frameworks, you come from backend world and you see a lot of frameworks. It just comes to you, just which one to pick? You can feel a bit overwhelmed by all the hypes in the front-end world. So would you choose Angular or React because I heard from a colleague it's nice, or why would you choose a particular framework? Well, Flux as well, or Meteor, just so much frameworks. You can look at popularity. It's pretty obvious that Angular is the most popular SPA framework at the moment. jQuery, you see it as well, is decreasing its popularity, and you see Angular is increasing its popularity, just as React, but it's still pretty new. But I would say this is not the right way of comparing frameworks with each other. What you have to do is just have to see for yourself what fits into your project. Do I need a whole SPA framework, or I just need some engine to handle the views, or engine to do some data binding? You just have to pick yourself. But we at Luminous, we like to work with Angular, especially when we're doing large web applications. So, in a nutshell, Angular is a rich MVW framework. So what do I mean with MVW? It's Model View Whatever. So in the beginning, Angular was an MVC framework. But later, the framework changed, and they refactored a lot, and it more became an MVVM framework. But within the Angular community, there was a lot of discussion. So is it MVC, is it MVVM? And later the Angular team responded with, it's whatever you want to do with it. It's MV whatever. So that's where it comes from. So as already said, Angular is suitable for large web application. It extends the HTML, so you can create elements, you can create extra tags in your HTML, so it can you can add extra behavior to it. Some of the major functionalities of a framework is are the dependency injection things and the data binding and what you have now components, and these are the things I'm gonna cover in here. And also, which is important to tell, it's testable from the ground up. So Angular is created with the test IDE in mind, so that especially if you create a large web application, unit testing is really important. So directives, I've already told, we extend the HTML so we can add behavior to your HTML elements. For in here, for example, ng repeat. So in this example, you see an array of talks. We're just going to repeat through the array of talk and show every talk. And we don't really care in here where the talks come from, but we just repeat to it, and we got it from a controller. Another thing is two-way data binding. So on our view, we have data, and it comes from the controller. But if you want to, change the data on the view, you want it to have reflected in the controller, and other way around as well. So if the controller receives data from a REST call or something else, or some other data source, you want to have it reflected in your view, and the other way around as well. If the user changes the data, you want to have it reflected in your backend of your frontend. So a little example. So you have a really simple controller here with the title. And in your view, you bind this title to an input. So whenever a user changes the text in the input, it will be changed in the controller as well. And it will be reflected directly into the H1 element below, because it changes in the controller, and the controller again updates the view. Dependency injection. So the idea is that, for example, controllers or servers aren't responsible for the creation of services they depend on. So Angular has this idea of dependency injection. In this example, you have a module tag days is dependent on the on a different module talks. So in order to resolve this dependency, you have to create a module talk, so this dependency can be resolved. And modules can register services as well. So here is the creation of the service. And you you register the service dependency in here. And in other parts of your code, you want to use this service to use its methods. You can just inject it using the same name as you registered it with. So in just throughout your application, you can use this service with using dependency injection. We're covering right now is Angular 1, but as you probably know, Angular 2 is on its way as well. It's actually already released. And one of the important things is components. Everything is a component. So the Angular 1 team have introduced components as well since 1.5. And the idea of components is that a component just controls its own data, which means it can't adjust the data outside of its own scope or outside its own part of the page. So it has its own view and data, has the well-defined inputs and outputs. So a component has a parent component, and just there's one-way data binding from the parent component into the child component, and the data goes out. So when within the component there's something changed, a field is updated, or something in the data of the component itself is changed, it is called into the parent component, and the parent component is responsible for changing the data. So the data of the component itself is, you can say, immutable, and the parent component is responsible for changing the data. And this way you can create a view of a tree structure of components. Yeah. So here an example of a component. So this is also the example the Angular team uses. So there's a hero detail component. So probably that contains hero data, one hero data. And you can, within the component, you can probably delete the hero and update the hero. So within the bindings, you see hero, that's the data binding. So there's one-way data binding, so it receives the hero object from its parent into the child component, and when you when a user, for example, deletes the component hero or updates the hero, it calls the onDelete and update on the parent component, and this way the data can be encapsulated. So we picked a framework, and Frank's going to talk about the rest.
So that's great. We got a language, we got a framework, we got a lot of stuff to get start building with. But now we have Angular, we've chosen Angular. So how are we gonna get Angular and other components? That's where package managers come in. We already know package managers from the backend world. For you .NET developers, you're probably familiar with NuGet, but also in the Java world, you have these. So in the front-end world, we also have package managers, and these are the two major ones, NPM and Bower. Whereas NPM is more for server-side dependencies, and Bower is more for front-end dependencies. Why do we talk about server-side dependencies if we're talking about building front-end applications? This is mainly for your build tooling, but also if you want to use JavaScript or TypeScript to build server-side applications, which is also possible. But we will mainly focus on Bower. He said this is going to get our libraries, which we need to build the actual applications. And most of this stuff also applies to NPM. It has the same syntax and the same way of working, but then for different type of dependencies. When you start a new project, you want to initialize a new project. This basically creates you a template where you will store all your dependencies and describe your project. You can see we have a name, a version, but moreover, dependencies. This is just a list of dependencies that your application needs. And what's very important, that it also has a version. So you get exactly the version your application depends on. It also makes it very easy to update. You can update to a minor or a major version quite easily. And then we also have development dependencies. So when you start building a large-scale application and you also want to do tests, you might have some frameworks you use in your front-end application to do testing. This is where dev dependencies come in. So you have a separation between your development dependencies and your dependencies you're really going to use within for building your application. So when you publish your application, you only want to publish the dependencies and not your development dependencies, because nobody's going to use Angular Mux for mocking frameworks when he's using the app. So you can install them, uninstall them, and update them. So where are these things hosted? They're mainly hosted on GitHub. So on GitHub, you can add a small file that Bower knows this is a JavaScript dependency or a Bower dependency, which you can register. They don't have to come from GitHub or even Git. They can come from subversioning or even a local file path. Very basically, maybe you have a shared drive where you want to store some JavaScript on and share it across your projects. You can use Bower to manage all this. And even if you find that very rare JavaScript file on this weird server, you can still hook it in up to Bower to download it for you. All right, package managers. So how are we going to manage all this? We have a language. We have a framework. But we don't want to do a lot of tasks over and over again. So what we want to use a build process for is to reduce repetitiveness, maybe compile code, optimize for production, and analyze. These things really come in play if your web application becomes bigger. So a few examples. Organize your files, maybe copy them from one place to another, minifying them. You don't want every time you release your application, go to an online minifier, minify your code, and copy to the production location. You want to have this automated. Concatenate your files, all the JavaScript files, make them into one, so this speeds up your loading in your browser. A very fancy feature, which unfortunately we won't have time to show you today, but is debugging TypeScript in your browser. So it means you can step through your TypeScript in for example, Chrome. Adding these to your code, you have to use a build process. Running tests, checking your code styles, reloading websites, there's a lot of things you can do with a build process. So how will this look like? This is a very simple example. On the left, we have a source directory, which will hold all your development code, your JavaScript files, your CSS, or maybe SAS, your images, your index. And you want to do something to these files and copy them to the output folder, which your project actually runs in. Maybe you want to publish for production. So what you will do is you probably will minify your code and then concatenate them and then put them to the output. So you're modifying your files and then writing them to different folder. Same for your CSS. Images, maybe you want to compress all your images before you publish them. Maybe you just get some images from the developer, just want to throw them in the folder, resize them, compress them. Maybe change all the PNGs to JPEGs. You can do all this in a build process. Even the HTML we can minify and maybe change the location of our source files. So then again, in the front-end world, there's a lot of different stuff. We have MS Build for .NET developers, and often we never think about a different tool. But in the front-end world, there's a lot of different options you have. We're going to mainly focus on Bower and Gulp, which are the main ones. But maybe next year this will change, and you should use one of those newcomers. So there's a lot of plugins for these. Grunt exists a little bit longer, so there's a little bit more plugins. But Gulp is picking up speed. They're a bit different. So where Grunt really relies on file copy. So when you want to minify a file, it will pick up the file, minify it, and write it back to file system. Whereas Gulp really uses streams. So when you want to minify it, it will pick it up, minify it, and then you can do another action to it. Maybe concatenate it, and it will all stay in memory. So this makes Gulp generally a bit faster. And there's a preference whether you want to configure your build process or code your build process. Where Grunt mainly uses a JSON file to configure your build process, Gulp uses a JavaScript file, which you write functions to express how your build process will work. At Luminous, we mainly use Gulp. I will go into Gulp a little bit more and we'll show you some examples. So Gulp is basically one file in your project. You can extend it out to make modules and configuration files, but generally it's one file. There are only 5 functions. It runs using Node.js. And installed using npm. So that's where npm comes into the picture and where you get your dependencies for Gulp, for example, for. Gulp you actually put in the root of your project and you can start writing JavaScript to make your build process. You will do this with only 5 functions. Task, source, pipe, dest, and watch. We will go into them in a bit more detail. So first tasks. So you want to do something in your build process. For example, minify files. This is where tasks comes in. So here we specify tasks to build our libraries. We can run this task from the command line, like you see here. Or Visual Studio also has built-in support, so you can use your interface within Visual Studio to run these tasks. And then the task will be executed. So you need to put stuff in the task. Well, first you will start with files you will want to modify. So in this case, we take all the JavaScript files from our libraries folder using a glob pattern, which uses pattern matching to find the right files. So now we have all the files in memory. Please go away. So now we can use the pipe syntax to actually modify this file stream, or this stream. And in this case, we use a library called concat, which we will load in up here using the require syntax, which is common to Node.js. And this is a plugin which we downloaded through npm. So npm we use npm to get plugins for our build process. So once we have included this plugin, we can use the pipe syntax to concatenate all the JavaScript files in our stream to one single file. And then we're almost there. Then we still need to write it to a certain destination. So we need to make sure it's written to our build folder so we can use it in our application. And then we have one more, which is a bit different. This is the watch. And the watch can listen to files in your on your disk. So for example, when I add a new library to my libs folder, I want it to automatically start building the libraries. So I also always know that my libraries in my output folder are up to date. So I add a watch, and it will automatically execute a certain task, in this case, build libs. So we're going to do a little demo of this. So I'm using Visual Studio Code, but you can use any editor you like. And I have a small application here, which is also available on GitHub. You can see all the sources. And I'm going to start to run this. So what it will do is run Gulp in my command line. So we'll kick off a whole bunch of tasks, hopefully. There we go. So, and you can see I use, in this case, an npm server to host this project. So if I will go there. I can see something is going a little bit wrong. It says Angular is not defined, so there must be something wrong with my libraries. So let me check. What's the first thing I would usually do is check my index page, see if I included Angular. I didn't, but there is there's supposed to be ellipse.js here. All right, so let's use that. Let's try it. See if that gets me my Angular. But you can see ellipse.js. It is found. Shit. Should not be there. I think it was still there from a previous build. Oh, wait. Oh, no, you're great. So. Actually, practice this stuff, and I forgot to take out the example code. So it works too well. It should fail, but it actually works. That's interesting. All right, I can't find ellipse. Damn it! Why can't I find it? Maybe because I just removed it. So we're going to check. To our build process, because our build process should produce the ellipse.js. What I did is I just run gulp, which means I run the default task. And if it's not a release build, it will run the clean and build task. Let's check that out. It's right up here. And it should do a build. Now let's check that out. So you can really nest these tasks to get a lot of stuff done. So here you can see a more complicated task, which depend on a lot of different tasks. The one I'm interested in this case is to build the libraries. Well, you already saw it, but it's right defined up here and it's empty. So that's why there's no ellipse. So let's see if we can get that to work. So already in the gulp task, which I explained before. So unfortunately, this is not TypeScript, so I don't have that great syntax. But what I will do is use the source syntax to get my library files. And I will do this using a plugin. I'm getting my dependencies through Bower, and this plugin knows exactly where my Bower files are, and if I download a plugin or a library through Bower, I want to use it. So what I will just say, I want to use all the libraries that have the extension .js, and I want all the files. So instead of writing the glob syntax, this will actually know how Bower works and which dependencies I need. All right, so I got them in memory. So I need a pipe syntax to concatenate these. Do a single file. So now I have them in memory in a nice new file. I need to output them to the right folder. Which is the build folder. All right, so that's a very simple way to write a task. Now let's see if it worked. So I have to run my build process again. And now hopefully the auto reload will work and it will refresh automatically. It didn't, but there it is, the library file. And it can't reach my server, but I'm not going to try to fix that. But at least the library's files there. You can actually look into it. And you can see all the files code is there. This is the development version of the ellipse.js. In production, I will, for example, add a task to make sure it's minified, just like I've concatenated it now. All right, there we go. Build tool. Questions can be after the presentation. We will go to the questions and answer lounge. A bit short on time. I got 5 minutes left. We still have to do a whole new and a whole other topic. But there's gulp. You can check out all the tools that are available. See which one you like best. But golf was definitely a good choice. So testing. Of course we need to do testing. Full applications are now built using JavaScript. So we got our code organized, placed into modules. And we got this huge code base, which different teams work on, a lot of the different developers, so we make sure our code quality is proper. There are three things I want to go through quickly. It's Karma, a Jasmine, and Angular Mux. Karma is your test runner. So we need to have a place and have a system that runs your tests. The tests obviously are running through a browser because it's JavaScript. And a neat thing about Karma is it can be started from gulp. So I have a gulp process that actually starts my tests. With Karma, you can choose which browser you want to use. So if there's differences between how JavaScript is rendered in various browsers, you can also detect this. I think the first three you're all familiar with. But the last one might be new. This is PhantomJS, which is a headless browser, which is a bit weird if you want to browse some websites, but it's great for testing and application development. It will just run your JavaScript without spinning up a whole UI. All right, so we have a place to run the tests. Now we need a framework that actually does the actual testing. We use Jasmine, and Jasmine gives us four main features which we're going to use to build up our test. The first one is describe. This describes a section of things you want to test, so you can create some modularity in your tests. In this case, we have describe our talk controller, so this will encapsulate all the tests for our talk controller. Then we have the before each. The before each will go off before every test, so you don't have to instantiate a new controller every time you run a test. So now you're sure every time you have a new controller in your tests. The actual thing you want to test, you will define in the it. So it should toggle the variable. In this case, the thing we want to test. And to make sure it actually does that, we use the expect keyword. So in this case, we check the property on the controller, whether it's true or false, see if it's correct. So Angular Mux, Steve already told you that by having dependency injection in Angular, it's really great for testing. Angular Mux helps you to spin up mock instances of Angular components. In this example, what we do is in the before each, we instantiate a talk service and a HTTP backend. We configure the HTTP backend to give back a certain response when called. So when the HTTP backend is called with a GET and this URL, it responds with a 500. And yet again, we can use this in our tests. And there's another neat feature from Angular Mux, which is the dump syntax, which just outputs all the object to the screen in a readable way. So you can use it for debugging and testing. I think our time is nearly up, so I'm going to leave it with that. Maybe I'll do a quick demo of something else. I'll go through it quickly, which is quality checking of your code. There's a lot of rules, and you see this in the backend world as well, is code guidelines. So make sure your team programs in a similar way, spaces are in a similar way, using spaces instead of tabs, for example, for laying out your code. This is a quick example. So we're using TSLint in our applications, which you can define rules, and rules need to apply for your whole team. So in this example, we want to use double quotes for our strings. Because in JavaScript, you also use single quotes, but it's very confusing. So we decided to create a rule that defines that you only can use double quotes. So now in our application, you can see one module is defined with single quotes, which is perfectly valid for JavaScript or TypeScript. But when we run our build process, it will give us a notice that we shouldn't use that. So your whole team is hereby forced to use double quotes for all their strings. Which I can do maybe quick. I have 1 minute left. So here we have another project in which I run this. There we go. So it's a similar build process to the previous time, only now there's a few mistakes in my code. Here you can see the same example. So when we go to the common module, we can see exactly that. Here there's the quotes defined. Wrongly. So now you can already see it reprocessed the file, so it knows we updated the file and saved it. So the build process run again, and now you can see only in the talk servers there's still some errors, missing white spaces, misplaced opening braces. So it can really get your team on one line and make sure you're all using the same standards. All right, that's it. There you have it. Well, we put Jasmine there, but obviously there's a few more tools that you will need. So we think this is a great way to do front-end development, which is very similar to the way you would do back-end development. And again, the questions can be done in the speaker's lounge later. We have to get out, I think.
Ja. Hoe ervaring met Bridge.net? Bridge.net.